It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at a new approach to early childhood education. It's called looping. We'll find out if it'll be coming to a school near you.
First, a new report out today from Citizen Action of Wisconsin details variations in healthcare costs around the state.
While costs are fairly high everywhere, the report shows that some regions of the state are paying thousands of dollars more for health insurance than others. But why?
Joining us now to get a handle on that question is Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, there seem to be some pretty significant regional differences in the cost of healthcare in Wisconsin. How typical is that?
Well, we've been doing this report for 8 years, and we found very large variations in the large group market, that is, insurance bought by medium and large companies. And they're 23% this year between the highest cost area, which is southeast Wisconsin, and the lowest cost, which is Madison. This year, we were able to add, because of the new health insurance marketplaces, both in small business insurance and also insurance people buying their own, and we found the variations even larger there, up to 55% between the high-cost area and the low-cost areas of the state. So where you live has a huge impact on just how high your health insurance premiums are going to be.
Now, why would that be?
Well, we've been looking at this for a number of years, and we've always thought it had most to do with the various cost of hospitals and providers in different regions of the state and whether they had how competitive they were with each other. But we found this year differences between the types of insurance in the same regions, which tells us that there may also be market distortions in the insurance market. So it may also have to do with insurance and how much profit there is and overhead there is per region or how much people are being charged, maybe being overcharged in some regions compared to others. But it's both underlying medical costs and health insurance itself and how it's sold and what the profit margin is.
So in general, would you say that paying more means that we get better coverage?
We have not found that this year or previous years. In fact, there's good quality data for large employers, and it finds that the highest cost area, southeast Wisconsin, has the lowest quality insurance, and some of the lowest cost areas, such as Madison, have the highest quality insurance. There are other high cost areas like northwest Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and La Crosse that both have high cost and high quality. So we didn't find any direct correlation. In fact, some of the most expensive insurance is the worst insurance.
Now, that's a pretty remarkable finding. Some of the most expensive insurance is the worst insurance. So what is happening to cause a result like that?
Well, a big variable is who sells the insurance. We found that the for-profit national companies like UnitedHealthcare, Humana, have lower quality insurance, where the in-state kind of provider-driven local companies, your group health cooperatives in Madison, for example, have the highest quality insurance. And so it's partly a matter of that. But this also relates to a lot of healthcare research that shows that cost and quality are not well connected at all. In fact, we know from a lot of national research that often the highest cost is lower quality. And so the real issue here is to get to value, to get as good a cost as possible for high-quality insurance and coverage, and we have a long way to go in Wisconsin and nationally to do that.
And I'm assuming that people don't know that. They're not saying, I'm going to buy a plan that costs me a lot more, but it's going to give me less. So how is this happening that people are ending up with plans like these?
Well, it's a lack of transparency in part. It's also part of a lack of regional choice, but we have a better sense, say, in buying an automobile, what a higher or lower quality is, at least in terms of what people are willing to pay for, right? In health insurance, that's not been the case. And I think as we go to these competitive marketplaces under the Affordable Care Act, people will be able to compare apples to apples much better. And so there should be, if we do this right, more competition. But if you're in southeast Wisconsin, for example, you have little choice up until now other than to choose a for-profit national health insurance company, which is high cost and low quality.
Well, you brought up the Affordable Care Act. Any sense so far about how that's going to be affecting things?
Well, we have first-year data, so we don't know how the inflation rate will go. We know, based on previously, that there's been a tripling of health insurance rates in Wisconsin. And so I think we think it's going to depend upon how it's implemented, and that's going to differ between states. A state like Minnesota is trying to use all the tools of the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin's government has not been inclined to do so. It's been very opposed to the law. But I would say that it provides more leverage, more mechanisms to try to take on costs, but it doesn't do so automatically. It depends on how you implement it and how you use it in each state.
Now, let's talk for a moment about large group health insurance plans. Now, it seems like they've more than doubled since 2000, according to your findings. What accounts for that? Is it just inflation?
We had a huge burst of health insurance hyperinflation starting in the year 2000. And it's moderated a little bit the last couple of years. In fact, we're at a 50-year low right now as far as hyperinflation and insurance. It's still higher than the cost of living is in terms of inflation. But we think that this system has been broken. This great inflation has occurred at the same time that plans have been hollowed out and have had less and less value and have shifted more and more costs on to individual consumers and patients. And so this is partly why we got healthcare reform in the first place. A lot of people, even in the healthcare industry, realized the pace of hyperinflation wasn't sustainable. And the one thing we have on the table now that could possibly come to terms with it, or at least moderate it, is the Affordable Care Act. But we're stuck in a debate about whether we'll keep that or not, rather than moving into the next question after coverage, which is cost.
Now, earlier you mentioned that one thing that could be responsible for getting, you know, an inferior plan that costs more is distortions in the market. What exactly does that mean?
Well, insurance companies, you would think it would, if it was a perfect market, then the rate would reflect what the underlying cost of medical care was. So the underlying cost of medical care in Green Bay ought to be the same no matter what type of insurance it is. It's the same hospitals, et cetera. And that doesn't seem to be the case, which would suggest that some people are getting much less value than others in terms of what the rate is versus what the underlying medical costs are. We've seen the same thing in comparing to Wisconsin to Minnesota, where the underlying medical costs are very similar, but the insurance rates are much higher in Wisconsin than Minnesota. And so that is the situation. Medical costs are a huge issue that we need to get our hands around, but there seem to also be distortions in the insurance market where some people are paying much more than others when medical costs in the area are similar.
Now, one thing we hear a lot about is that the boomer generation is huge and it's aging and requiring a lot of health care. Is that something that's having any sort of play here?
Well, if you have an older population, it does need more medical care. That's absolutely true. But the system that has had the least inflation overall is Medicare, which, of course, is the oldest population. It's seniors. And if you have higher utilization groups, the quality becomes even more important. In other words, having good screenings, having chronic disease management where you work with people who have chronic diseases to make sure they don't get sicker and don't end up in life-threatening situations that are costly to address. And so, in fact, the older the population is, the more important it is that the high-quality coverage that invests in prevention, chronic disease management, and other things that keep people healthier and intervene earlier in the process before they're very sick and costlier to medicate or to treat.
Now, what is the takeaway here as you see it, both for healthcare consumers and for policymakers?
What we found, two findings we made in this report is, one, it looks like Madison rates are lower because they have, in the large group market, because of all the state employees who are in a competitive bidding process. That's how the state employee plan works. It would suggest we should grow the new state marketplaces to have more participants so there's more market power to bargain with insurance companies and medical providers. The second is, with these distortions, we really, in the insurance market, we really should look at rate reviews. States that have had robust rate review where they make insurance companies justify their rates and block rates that are excessive, aren't based on real data and facts, have lowered rates. And Wisconsin is not doing that and could. So I think it really, that these are examples of where we need to use all the tools available to address this problem, because it's a huge problem for business competitiveness and just for individuals to be able to afford insurance, which is a necessity in the 21st century. So we just need to work on this together as a major public policy issue going forward and not just get caught in this perpetual loop around the Affordable Care Act that we've been having for the last 4 years.
Robert, thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking to Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll find out about looping in childhood education, what it is and how it might shake up the traditional early education model. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. About 12 years ago, the Northern Door Children's Center in Sister Bay adopted a new approach to early childhood education called looping.
Here to explain what looping is and what it does for young kids is Karen Corkin. She's Community Relations Coordinator for the Northern Door Children's Center. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So it sounds like some crazy tricycle stunt. I'm guessing it's not quite that fun, but what exactly is looping?
Well, looping is a process in which children, a group of young children, come together. Usually we start a group about 6 weeks old, because we do have quite a few children that come to us that young. They join either one or two teachers, depending on the number of children in the classroom, and those children and those teachers stay together for 3 years. So instead of, which is what's more typical in early childhood education, children changing classrooms and changing teachers with every developmental milestone, instead, the group stays together. So it's the same peers, the same teachers, and they change classrooms, but they do it together.
What are the benefits? Why make this change?
Well, what happens is when a child has to make a major change, like giving up somebody who's a significant adult in their life, a teacher that they've had for, you know, 6 months to a year, when they have to make that change and give that person up and move to and have to make new connections, it's very stressful. The children actually do go through a grieving process, and that will slow down the learning process. Also, what slows it down is the teachers then have to learn the children, you know, new children all over again, and then they're also having to adjust to new peers. All of that slows down that process because they're losing that learning time, where for us, with the looping process, when our children change classrooms, they do it with their same peers that they've been with since they were infants, with the same teacher who has known them for their whole life, and for them, a new classroom is just new activities, new toys, you know, a lot of fun to go with their educational experience. So the stress that comes with that constant changing is removed in the looping process.
What kind of reactions have you seen from kids over the long term of doing this?
Well, it's interesting. Our first group has actually started the sixth grade this year, and as each group has gone along, those connections the children have made with each other have stayed very, very strong. They have those connections, and the connections that their families have with the teachers and with the other families is continues to be very strong. I mean, we are a small community up here, but I think that's true of any program that chooses to do a looping program. They make those very strong connections, and it's just very healthy for them in their terms of their social emotional development, and then the families as well. There's just not the stress of having to adjust to a new person who is their child's teacher constantly. The parents and the teachers are able to form very, very strong partnerships that work for the benefit of the children.
And, yeah, do you see a better sense of communication there, teacher and parent and kid to teacher, for that matter?
Absolutely. Because you begin to know these children, you know, it's in so many ways as though they're your own because you're with them so much. I actually did a loop of children myself, and that I still have the connections to them. They're all going into they just went into the fourth grade this year, and the connection that you have is so strong with that family, you just don't lose that. It's, in a lot of ways, the children become almost like siblings, and it just really, really makes a huge difference in how the brain grows. It's very positive. It's a very positive effect on children's brain growth.
For the teachers, you and the others, is there some trepidation going in? It's a very different sort of thing. When you start this class, you know you're in with them for 3 years.
Absolutely. And I'll have to say that's one of the things that's really important for any early childhood center or school that's going to try, you know, getting the looping process going, is you have to have teacher buy-in, because, you know, teachers in the early childhood education setting are very much like teachers in the elementary and middle and high school, that graded school where you're used to teaching a particular thing. What happens with looping then is that you have to be able to plan the educational experiences for children all the way through. So you're constantly learning and growing along with the children. And so there was, yeah, definitely some trepidation for some of our teachers at first. But, you know, after a few years, really no one could remember what it was like before, because everyone had really begun to see the incredible benefits that we were seeing with the children in terms of their learning, in terms of their socialization. You know, all of their development was so enhanced, and we could really see the difference.
But I wonder, eventually they're going to get to a school level where they're switching classes each year, or then eventually switching classes each hour, going from math to science or what have you. Isn't there some benefit to experiencing the change early on, seeing different styles, different types of people up in front of them teaching?
Definitely, and that's why we did some experimenting with it, and we did try a five-year loop where the same teacher stayed with children for 5 years. But we did find that those first 3 years are the most critical in terms of children's development, and so we've kept the loop to the first three years. Once they've completed the first 3 years, one of the looping teachers will make the transition with them into preschool to a new teacher, help them get settled in, and then that teacher goes back and starts a new loop. So now the children have, an entirely new teacher. And because they have those strong foundations and the strong skills that they've gotten in those first 3 years, they're very, very comfortable, starting with a new teacher because they're, very confident. And then when they've completed their preschool experience and we have a four-year-old kindergarten program, they move to the next teacher. So they do have that opportunity to experience changing teachers. But it's those first 3 years that are just so critical in terms of children's development, and those strong attachments really, really make a difference.
And in terms of development, I suppose somebody 3 years old and younger is very different developmentally than somebody when they hit elementary school age.
Absolutely, because we're looking at so many different pieces of the children's development. As early childhood educators, we're focused on all aspects of the development. So, in the beginning with young infants, there is quite a bit of care that is required, and changing diapers and feeding and all of those things. But each of those things gives you an opportunity. We call them teachable moments, great opportunities for doing learning activities with children. So even those first 3 years, just a lot of learning going on.
I don't know if this is the case this early on, but sometimes you hear of or experience in school at some point a bad match between a teacher and a student. Mm-hmm. What happens if you're stuck there for 3 years in a bad match, or maybe between the teacher and the parent at that age?
Well, it's interesting because we kind of look at the relationship between the teacher, the parent, or the family and the children. In some ways, it's almost like a marriage. You make a commitment to make it work. And so if there's issues, we really, really work through them. And frankly, we haven't had that much of a problem because everybody is clear at the very beginning that we're all here for the children. We're here for the very best interests of what is good and best practice for the children. And so, that's been a very rare occurrence, but it's very much like a marriage. You are committed to it and you make it work for those 3 years.
You're doing this there in Sister Bay. I understand that this is done elsewhere. Do you have a sense of how widespread this is, or is looping something that's really new and not a lot of people are jumping on it yet?
I don't think it's particularly new in terms of elementary school, and I know if anyone's familiar with Waldorf education, now that's a particular type of educational system where a group of children and teachers will often stay together for 8 to 9 years. But it's not quite as widespread as I think it should be in early childhood education, because to be honest with you, it's not an easy process. It's very easy just to move children from class to class. But we talk a lot here at the Children's Center about the integrity of the loop. We hang on to the integrity of the loop. We keep those children together, and making the change, deciding when they're going to make a move to another classroom, and all of those things. It's a little complicated, and I know we actually did a presentation about looping at the National Association for the Education of Young Children, their national conference several years ago. And that was the big question everybody kept saying is, how do we make this work? And it's not easy, but it is definitely what is best for children.
Yeah,
there's no question.
When you introduce this idea to somebody in the industry, in the profession, who hasn't tried it, do you get a lot of quizzical looks and skepticism?
I think everyone would probably agree who's read the research on the continuity of the educational experience for young children, because that's what looping is. It's about that continuity of education. I think they would all agree that it's definitely best for children. I just think, you have to be willing to make that commitment, and not everybody is. But it's just a commitment to knowing what is very, very best for children and being willing to do that. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to have an opportunity to speak about looping, because it's worth it. It is definite for any early childhood facility or organization. It is absolutely worth doing.
So you'd say it's worth that initial upfront work and getting things right, and any daycare out there or any early education center, you'd say give it a shot?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think is really, really helpful is for families, parents to understand the importance of this and for them to ask for it. Parents should advocate for their children's school or care providers to do this, because it's definitely what's best for them as a family and for their children.
Karen, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
That's Karen Corkin. She's Community Relations Coordinator for the Northern Door Children's Center up in Sister Bay.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll learn about the color of 2014, something called Radiant Orchid. What is the color and how is it chosen? A color expert will fill us in.
As always, I don't know if it's blue or red or green. If you get outside of that basic color palette, I really don't know
how to
picture. Purple you're going to go with for orchid. Okay. All right. We'll also discuss the top words of the year with language expert Ben Zimmer.
And we'll talk to fantasy and science fiction author George R.R. Martin about his latest anthology, Dangerous Women.
That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll meet two men who went undercover as homeless people in Madison. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The U.S. Senate is poised to pass a bipartisan budget deal today, months after gridlock brought the government to a shutdown. Next hour, we'll hear how we arrived at this bipartisan agreement.
First, every year, 3,500 people in Madison experience homelessness. Those are the numbers in the heart of Wisconsin's economically prosperous Dane County.
Last month, in an effort to better understand that experience, three community leaders went undercover as homeless people for a week.
They panhandled and slept in shelters. And after documenting their week and sharing it in local papers and social media, they got an outpouring of interest from the community.
Got a couple of them with us here today in the studio. Michael Johnson is CEO of Dane County's Boys and Girls Club, and Tim Metcalf is president of Metcalf's Market, and they're here with us now to talk about their experiences. Tim and Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Veronica.
And you did this for what, 3 days, right?
Yeah, two nights and 3 days.
Tell us, Michael, let's start with you. How did you first come up with this idea? So to live among the homeless is one of them.
I just got to say, first, you got a great radio voice.
Says the guy with a great radio voice.
let me just say it started by we started seeing so many kids coming into our Boys and Girls Club that was either living in their vehicles, and we were picking up kids from homeless shelters all across the city. And I wanted to see homelessness from the lens of a homeless person and not necessarily from the lens of the Boys and Girls Club CEO. So I called my friend Tim Metcalf. I called my friend Will Green from the Salvation Army and said, hey, would you all be willing to go out with me firsthand and sleep in shelters, sleep on the streets to see what young people go through in their families in the city? And that's how y'all got started.
And Tim, went through your head when Michael came to you with his idea of living out there as a homeless person. What did you think?
Well, Michael comes to me quite often with different ideas of things that he wants to explore in the community, and I have a problem spelling the word no, so I usually just say yes. But my first initial thought was, you know, absolutely, I'd love to join you. What I wanted to learn was where the children are, where the families are. I know in Madison that about 1,100 children are homeless every night in Madison. And
say that number again. How many?
1,100 tonight.
1,100.
Yeah, we'll be homeless tonight in Madison. And so what I wanted to find out is, you know, where the families are, where the children are, and what makes a family go homeless, and, you know, what are some of the struggles that they have when they're homeless in Madison.
And Michael, that was true of you too, right? You really wanted to see what was happening to the children.
Yeah, I mean, that's the business that we're in. We're about providing opportunities and making sure that our young people have great futures, and we want to make sure that our kids succeed. And our kids can't succeed if they're sleeping in vans, if they're sleeping on the streets. And so in order for our kids to graduate from high school, to graduate from college, we have to address the family. And so we wanted to elevate the conversation. We wanted to figure out a way to motivate people to get involved. And I'm hoping one day we can live in a community where no kid in this community will be living homeless in a city like Madison.
And so you said a city like Madison, part of Dane County, and we usually think of Dane County as doing pretty all right for itself when it comes to, you know, the economy. How widespread is homelessness in Dane County, Tim?
Well, I think the numbers that are published by Dane County is roughly about, I think it's 3,500 individuals will experience homeless every year. And of that, there's 1,200 children, roughly 1,100 children that are experiencing it. And of that, 600 of those children will actually go into a shelter. Many of the children that are designated as being homeless don't go to the shelters. They're living in cars with their parents or their mother or their father. So roughly about 3,500 people a year experience homelessness in Madison.
I'm guessing that every story is unique, but Michael, what do we know about how people become homeless? How does it happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a variety of different things. And I think there's a lot of people that's one paycheck away or two paychecks away from becoming homeless. And I think what really surprised us, we stayed at a local shelter, Porch Light, and we found that there were actually people getting up and going to work. And that surprised me and Tim a little bit. And there was and there's a couple of issues that we're facing in our city. There's a shortage of low-income housing. If you have a felony or if you have bad credit, you're going to have a hard time getting an apartment here. And so that's part of the issue that we need to address. And if you don't have a job and don't have family and friends here, you're probably going to end up on the streets with a lot of people. And so I think we have to figure out some short-term and long-term solutions to address this issue.
Well, so you decided, you got your buddy Tim, you have your other friend, Mr. Green,
you
decided this is something you were going to do. You guys were going to live on the street as homeless people. How do you prepare for something like that, Michael?
It was a very humbling experience, but our goal was to befriend a family and see if we could provide some support and connect services around a family right away, and we were able to do that. So we found a young mother, her four kids sleeping in a Walmart parking lot. We partnered with the row home. We got her an apartment, got her house furnished, poured her kids off the streets, and she had a party last week and she moved in. So we were able to do that. The second thing that for us, it was, you know, Tim is one of our supporters at Boys and Girls Club. And for me personally, I wanted to know what was all the resources that was out there. So when a kid come to our doors and we see the issues that they go through, who can I call? And what's the network of people that we can reach out to as a nonprofit leader in this community? So we met so many organizations that do work on the ground level with homeless folks all the time. But what we have found that this issue is so polarizing that there's so many groups that's divided. And as a community, we're not working hand in hand to make sure that those who need us the most get the support that they deserve.
So you said it's polarizing. I don't know. Maybe this is a naive question. Why is it polarizing? People don't want homeless people out there. We want to help them, right? So, Tim, maybe you can speak to that. Why is homelessness a polarizing issue?
You know, I don't know if I have that exact answer. Is you know, first of all, you know, Michael and I are new to this. You know, this was something that Michael had a real concern over. You know, and how it affected the kids at Boys and Girls Club. So we went out to learn more about this. There's a lot of people on the ground, like Michael says, that have been working very hard for many years. And it's, you know, they're looking for solutions. They're looking for, you know, it to end. They work very hard, and it continues. And you try to help somebody, and you know, they don't accept that help. So I think people get tired, and then they're screaming for help. And they all have individual, I want to call them silos. You know, this group is working on affordable housing. This group is working on the immediate needs of, you know, just people surviving the next couple of nights. This group is doing day shelters. So they all have their individual things that they're working on. But they sometimes they don't work collectively. And one of the things I think Michael and I have been able to do, and we saw this in an outreach that we were part of last week, is we brought a lot of people together, the community, the agencies, and we were able to service roughly about 500 people last Thursday night.
And I'll add to that, it was powerful. Tim led the effort on that particular one. Lands End, local business in town, stepped up, made $30,000 worth of, gave us $30,000 worth of coats and boots and supplies. And I think people will be shocked. There's 41 different camps where adults and children are sleeping in the woods, in tents, because they don't have a place to stay. And I don't think a lot of people in this community realize that. So last Thursday was just absolutely amazing to see all these nonprofit groups, to see all of the homeless advocates, to business leaders step up to help this vulnerable population. And that's what we should be doing as a community, making sure whether it's supporting kids, whether it's supporting the most vulnerable people in our community, how do we use our lives to touch another life?
Now, you guys did this to raise awareness around homelessness, to rally people to the cause and get coordination among the various arms who are working on this, but you also experienced it. I wonder if you could just share some of your stories, your impressions from those 3 days, what it was like.
Well, I'll start with that.
Time.
Yeah. Well, I guess the first thing I would say is, in a way it was a part. You know, Michael and I are not homeless, so it's really hard to fully understand what the feelings or the thoughts that are going through a person that has lost their house, lost their job, lost their family, and you're on the streets. But I do have to say, I did feel that. I was on a corner. I was holding a sign asking for money for my next meal. And people would drive by me and they would look and I could see in their eyes. And there were different emotions that I would feel. I would feel shame. I would feel hopelessness. I would feel despair. I would think to myself, you know, is this what my life has really become? Is that I have to beg for my next meal? And you feel that. And it's a very low feeling. And then somebody drives up to you and rolls their window down and says, and you say, you know, can you spare a dollar or some change? And they say, no, I can't give you money, but are you hungry? And the answer was, yeah, I am hungry. Well, can I buy you a meal?
Oh.
And then this particular person drives me to a restaurant, buys me a meal, and we went to a Kentucky Fried Chicken. Doesn't buy me a single meal deal. He buys me a bucket of chicken, and I asked him. I said, I can't repay you right now. I'm not able to do that. But can I get your name and number? How can I repay you? And his answer was, you know, when I was down on my luck, somebody reached out and helped me. So, you know, man, you know, this is just a temporary time for you. You're going to get on your feet. I know you will. And just when you do, pay it forward. And that happened to Michael and I maybe 2 or 3 times during the night where people reached out and touched us and helped us by either giving us money for our next meal or buying us a meal. And we would ask them, how can we thank you? How can we repay you? And to a T, they all said, you know, when I needed help, you know, I'm a single mom was one of them. And someone helped me. And when you get on your feet, just pay it forward. And I think that was a really powerful message that we got that night.
Well, thanks for sharing that. And maybe one quick story from you, Michael, before we catch some news.
Yeah, I would say for me, it was, you know, being African-American and Tim being a Caucasian man, I thought people would treat me different. And I think what was amazing, when I was out there panhandling, we were right in front of Westtown Mall. There was an elderly couple, I would say probably around 65 to 70 years old, pulled up and said, son, do you have a place to stay tonight? And I didn't know how to respond. So I said, yeah, I'm going to be staying at a shelter. That's where my family is at. So the guy looks at his wife. He said, me and my wife would take care of you. He said, digest what I just said and I'll come back and we'll talk. And I just started tearing up. I couldn't control my emotion. So as I'm crying right on the street, one of my Boys and Girls Club kids pull up. And I was afraid that he was going to recognize me. So I had my head down. And then I think he was in his girlfriend's car. So he raids her like glove department or the armrest and takes all her change and gives it to me. Mm-hmm. And it was just a very humbling experience. And then real quick from there, me and Tim went to two separate restaurants. I went to Perkins. Guy sat me down, told him I didn't have any food to eat. God not only fed me, but gave me a ton of food to go, and then gave me a card and was like, if you ever need us, you come back and give me a phone call.
Wow. So much that you experienced, and I'm sure it changed you. We'll hear about that when we come back. We're speaking with Michael Johnson, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and Tim Metcalf, president of Metcalf's Market, talking about the 3 nights that they spent, or 3 days, undercover as homeless people to experience that and to draw attention to the cause of homelessness during this time of the year when a lot of people need warmth and they need help.
And we'd like to hear from you about homelessness in your community. Have you experienced homelessness or you're experiencing it now? We'd like to hear your story. Or do you work with homeless people? Tell us about the services you provide and what life is like for the people you serve. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Michael Johnson, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and Tim Metcalf, president of Metcalf's Market. They went undercover as people experiencing homelessness last month to raise awareness of that issue.
And you can join in with your thoughts and questions about homelessness at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Well, let's get right to the phones. We've got some folks waiting to talk to you already. Let's go to Catherine first in Milwaukee. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, great. I just want to thank your guests for coming on today and for you talking about this topic. I am one of the coordinators for the Homeless Education Program in the Milwaukee Public Schools. And the whole purpose of our services is to provide families that are currently without, who have lost their permanent housing and are living in shelters or on the streets or doubled up with other families. And I just, one thing that spoke out to me listening to your guest today is it's one thing to be able to serve the members of this population, but then for them to go out and experience themselves, I think is really a wonderful thing to do, and I hope that more of us in that profession have the ability to do that someday, because I'm sure you got a whole different perspective and understanding from that experience, and I'm sure it's going to help you serve that population better. So I can take my comments off the air, but I also just kind of wanted to plug the MPS Homeless Program as well for those who might be listening in the state of Wisconsin and not necessarily know that we have those services for students in the schools and their families.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that, Catherine. And Michael, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, Catherine, I just want to say thank you for all of the work that you do in Milwaukee. I know that you all have some challenges in your neck of the woods. And I think when it all comes down to it, we have to figure out from our local municipalities to our philanthropic community to nonprofits, how do we leverage our collective resources to get the folks that need our services? How do we maximize our collective efforts? And so one of the reasons I invited Tim as a well-respected businessman in this community, Tim has some contacts that I may not necessarily have. I have some contacts that Tim may not necessarily have. And I think it's powerful to see two people who may come from two different spectrums of the universe to come together around a common issue. And if we can learn to do that across America and bring different groups and different communities together, those who need us the most can get the services that they need. So continue to do what you're doing. And keep the faith, and one day we're gonna have to solve this issue.
Well, I know people are listening right now and they're thinking, how can I help? We know what you guys did with your organizations and it's something you care about day to day. Tim, how can people help?
Well, first, let me say that one of the things that I really experience, and I have to honestly say, it's changed me. And that is sitting there on a corner watching people go by. I think the very first thing that I felt was fear. If I give you a dollar, what are you going to do with it? So I think people in general have a fear of this community in terms of how do I participate, how do I give, how do I get involved. And I think what my message to them is that you can get involved. We just did this recent drive to get jackets and that type of stuff for the homeless community. And what I really learned is that people really care. They want to be involved. They just don't know how to give. And there's some easy ways. There's the Salvation Army kettle campaign that's going on. That is, they're in the trenches working with the homeless community. There's Porch Light here in Madison and many other different agencies throughout the state.
Row Home.
And you can give directly to them. They're in the trenches and they're working with the homeless. And the other one is United Way. As a business owner, many businesses participate with the United Way. And as a business owner, you should feel good about that. And then if you're an employee and you're giving money to the United Way, you should feel good about that. And it's not how much you give. Whatever you can give. If you want to get involved.
Okay, I just want to get to this one call, Michael. Let's get back to, then we'll get back to what you were going to say. Let's go to Tricia next in Menominee. Hi, Tricia.
Hi. I guess really what I wanted to say is when I was a child, me and my three younger siblings as well as my parents lived in campgrounds in California. And the way it works in that system there is that you can stay in a campground for 30 days and then you have to leave for 15 days and then you can go back to another campground. And I think I saw a lot of the stress on my parents for just trying to find us food and basic necessities was huge. But the other part of the stress that I don't think it's talked about a lot is that my parents were in constant fight or flight mode. They were constantly worried about what was going to happen to us kids. They had to protect us from, there was a lot of people that lived in the campgrounds that were, drug users and abusers and, constantly trying to protect us from those kind of threats. It was very, very stressful on my parents. And we saw the effects of that stress. We saw the the mental health breakdowns because of that. And so it's been very, I think, interesting to me to now, now I'm successful professional and I'm, trying to, when I go into homes, I definitely am aware that when people have been homeless, that there is that other aspect that I don't think gets talked very much about.
All right. Tricia, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And Michael, Tricia talking about the stress that families are under, and that's something that's dear to your heart, looking out for those kids. What would you say to Tricia and again, people who want to help?
I think she needs to do exactly what she's doing. Volunteer your time. United Way has a website called volunteeryourtime.org. Donate your time, your talent, or your treasure. Tim talked about the variety of different agencies that do this work every single day. So if you could volunteer your treasure can go a very long way.
And if I can just add to that, Michael, one of the things that we experienced out there was that 80% of the people that we met had jobs. They just didn't have housing. And I think there's a misconception of what homelessness is in today's age and in the community. We see the people on the streets that are homeless, but what we don't see are the invisible ones, the ones that just spent the night and then went to work.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been speaking to Michael Johnson, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and Tim Metcalf, president of Metcalf's Market. They've been talking about how they went undercover as people experiencing homelessness last month and how it changed them and how people can help.
Coming up, from a government shutdown to a two-year budget. How do we get there? We'll find out. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.